Hi there, I'm Tom Morton, and you're listening to Hindsight on ABC Radio National. And today, we're back at the Berlin Wall for the final episode of Torn Curtain, the secret history of the Cold War. You could say that the sound we're hearing now, the clinking of hammers and chisels chipping away at bits of the wall in early 1990, is the sound of hope. Because the ending of the Cold War is surely one of the most extraordinary stories of hope in recent human history. What the British historian Eric Hobsbawm called the short 20th century, stretching from the Russian Revolution in 1917 to the fall of the Wall in 1989, was stained with the blood of millions murdered in the name of ideology. It's all the more remarkable, then, that the Cold War ended in a wave of peaceful revolutions which swept across Eastern Europe with hardly a shot being fired. But as we'll hear today, it could all have been very different. The 1980s are remembered now as the decade in which American strength and determination under the presidency of Ronald Reagan led to the final collapse of communism. Yet the world nearly paid a terrible price for Reagan's uncompromising stand against the evil empire in the early 1980s. Today, in the final episode of Torn Curtain, we reveal the most terrifying secret of them all.
I want to confirm, is this an exercise?
Let us pray for the salvation of all of those who live in that totalitarian darkness.
Every Soviet official I met was running around like a chicken without a head, talking in the most ghastly and dire terms about of real hot war, of fighting war, of nuclear war.
Conventional wisdom has it that the most dangerous moment of the Cold War was the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962, when the United States and the Soviet Union came within a hair's breadth of mutually assured Armageddon. But there was another, scarcely less perilous crisis much closer to the present, the nuclear war we nearly had in 1983.
Roger, copy. This is not an exercise.
Roger, understand. Major Reinhardt, we have a massive attack against the U.S. at this time. ICBMs.
Let us be aware that while they preach the supremacy of the state, they are the focus of evil in the modern world.
They were extremely frightened of some kind of large military exercise by NATO in the autumn of 83.
Most Australians remember 1983 as the year we won the America's Cup. But as we were basking in the glow of victory and sleeping off our hangovers, half a world away in Europe, the last great confrontation of the Cold War was moving towards its climax. Today, we tell the extraordinary story of how that confrontation nearly ended in catastrophe. It's a story that was shrouded in secrecy at the time, known only to a handful of politicians, spies and military leaders in East and West.
There was a fear in Moscow that the NATO exercise Able Archer in November 1983, which was an exercise which escalated from a conventional conflict with the Soviet Union in Europe to simulated nuclear release, that this exercise was being used, if you like, as a cover for an actual nuclear attack.
The fact was that during the Able Archer, in that period of the autumn 83, September, October, November, when the attitude of the Soviet leadership to that idea that the America was preparing a sudden nuclear attack outside context of a conflict, that hysteria was very high. And it was, so in a way, we were very close to a nuclear conflict.
Oleg Gordievsky, the former chief of the KGB station in London. Gordievsky defected to Britain in the mid-1980s. But it was only after the end of the Cold War that he spoke publicly about what's come to be known as the 1983 War Scare. According to Gordievsky, the world came closer to the brink of the nuclear abyss in November 1983 than at any time since the Cuba crisis. To understand just how we got to that point, We need to go back first to the early months of 1981. Ronald Reagan has just become President of the United States, and already he's calling for a crusade for freedom. Negotiation and dialogue with the Soviets are out, confrontation is back, and détente is dead.
They're squealing like they're sitting on a sharp nail, simply because we now are showing the will that we're not going to let them get to the point of dominance where they can someday issue to the free world an ultimatum of surrender or die. And they don't like that.
You know, Reagan had looked at the détente period of the 1970s as having been a one-way street to the Soviet advantage, and he felt he had to balance things a bit before he could go into effective negotiations. He was feeling that the United States at that point was too weak to negotiate directly at that time. It was significant to Reagan psychologically because as long as he felt weak, he felt that he really was not strong enough to go to the negotiating table effectively.
Jack F. Matlock Jr., principal advisor to Ronald Reagan on the Soviet Union and later U.S. ambassador to Moscow.
They were supporting insurgencies in Africa and Latin America, and then, of course, they had invaded Afghanistan. That was the big one before Reagan came to office. And then when they deployed the SS-20s, the intermediate-range missiles in Europe, this tended to upset what had been declared as a balance before.
The American Defense Secretary, Mr. Weinberger, at his first news conference at the Pentagon, has sounded the bugle call this way.
It is essential that we commence now, I think, on a very definite goal of substantially increasing the strength of America and our ability to respond to situations that may occur simultaneously in different parts of the world. And that's essentially what I have in mind when I say it's time to rearm America.
Ronald Reagan promised to counter what he called the unilateral disarmament of America during the 1970s. So when Reagan came into office in early 1981, there was not only calls to build up military forces, but also much more skepticism towards arms control and also a lot more loose talk on the part of some Reagan administration incoming officials about the possibility of fighting and even winning or prevailing in the terms of the military document that was released, leaked to the press in 1982, prevailing in a nuclear war with the Soviet Union.
James Hirschberg, founding director of the Cold War International History Project and now associate professor at George Washington University. One of Ronald Reagan's first actions as president was to bring in a massive boost in defense spending. The United States began the largest peacetime military buildup in its history. President Reagan and his key advisors argued that America was failing to keep pace with the Soviet Union.
One of our highest priorities has to be the modernization of our strategic nuclear forces and to restore our nuclear deterrent. Our deterrence to continue to be successful in the future, we have to work to offset the Soviet military buildup and to restore the nuclear balance. I refer to them as these terrible equations that we have to work with and recast every day.
Caspar Weinberger, Ronald Reagan's first Secretary of Defense. Weinberger and other key officials such as Richard Perle argued that unless drastic action was taken, a window of vulnerability would open in the mid-1980s. At that point, the Soviets would achieve overwhelming military superiority, a position of such strength that they could bring the United States to its knees.
The United States must restore that nuclear balance, and if we fail to do so, the Soviet Union could, within a few years, be in a position to threaten us, blackmail our allies, or even launch a nuclear attack with the assurance that we would not be capable of responding in a way that would constitute effective deterrence.
It's enough to make you wonder sometimes if you're on the right planet.
The Soviet Union, Soviet leaders had, of course, contributed to the fact there would be a time of tension, but Reagan was also inclined for political reasons, and I'm not saying he didn't believe it, to overstate Soviet superiority.
One man who spent a lot of the Cold War studying the Soviet military is Raymond Gartoff. In the late 50s, he worked for the CIA preparing national intelligence estimates, top secret evaluations of Soviet military strength. He was an advisor to President Kennedy during the Cuba crisis. So I asked Raymond Gartoff, was the doomsday scenario of Soviet military superiority, which Caspar Weinberger and Ronald Reagan talked about in the early 80s, a realistic one?
Well, you described it very well. It wasn't realistic at all. In fact, the United States was moving forward with programs which greatly increased our own counterforce capability, and the Scowcroft Commission by 1983 had also, even in the Reagan administration, had reached the conclusion that the so-called window of vulnerability wasn't there. That was clearly exaggerated with respect to the prognoses of Soviet superiority.
Military strength is most successful if it's never used, but if we're to avoid that use of force, we have to be prepared to use it and use it successfully. And in doing so, we're confronted with an age-old and fundamental paradox. To ensure the peace, we must be prepared for war. Prepared for war. Must be prepared for war.
Caspar Weinberger, speaking at the National Press Club in Canberra in 1982. Earlier that year, Weinberger had declared that the United States must be prepared to fight and win a nuclear war against the Soviets. A top-secret Defense Department document, which was leaked to the press, spelled out America's new nuclear policy.
Should deterrence fail and strategic nuclear war with the USSR occur, the United States must prevail and be able to force the Soviet Union to seek earliest termination of hostilities on terms favorable to the United States.
There was talk about a military nuclear warning shot. There was talk about a need to build civilian shelters for nuclear war. So in general, all this rhetoric started heating up quite a bit. And there was also a much more gung-ho attitude in Washington about supporting anti-Soviet and anti-communist forces around the world. So in general, Moscow perceived accurately a more aggressive posture in Washington when Reagan came into office.
Take the M out of MAD, let's all make a bomb. When the British pop group Heaven 17 wrote the chorus to that 1981 release, they didn't know that Caspar Weinberger would soon be following their advice. Weinberger revoked the doctrine of MAD, mutually assured destruction, a doctrine which had kept the nuclear peace for a generation.
Military establishments are always inclined to see as an objective victory if war should come, but to treat it in the way that many figures in the Reagan administration, and particularly Cap Weinberger, did, was clearly, again, building more of a sense of danger and crisis than was at all warranted. And this underlay the buildup of forces, but it also had the effect of alarming the Soviets, who were aware that they did not have superiority and were not about to achieve it, and that they could only, therefore, judge that the United States was doing this in order to provide a greater superiority to itself, and that in turn, was exceedingly dangerous from their standpoint.
Raymond Gartoff. In the corridors of the Kremlin, voices were being raised which were no less hawk-like than those issuing from the Pentagon. Here's what the Soviet military's chief of staff, Marshal Nikolai Ogarkov, told his counterparts in the Warsaw Pact in September 1982.
Соединенные Штаты уже давно ведут с нами скрытую войну.
The US has in effect already declared war on us.
Как показывают недавние маневры НАТО, это уже смертельно опасная игра.
The material preparations for war, as shown also by the current maneuvers of the NATO states, are no game, but deadly serious.
Вероятность атомной войны никогда не была так низка.
The danger of war has never been so great. From the late 1970s, Marshal Agarkov had argued that the Soviet Union should be prepared to strike first with nuclear weapons if war seemed unavoidable. Agarkov's views were regarded as extreme by more moderate elements in the Kremlin. But in 1981, a special intelligence operation, codenamed Operation Ryan, was set up by the KGB chief, Yuri Andropov, to look for signs that the United States or its allies were preparing for war.
Indeed, in the beginning of 1981, the Soviet intelligence services instituted a special state of warning to be on the alert for a possible Western initiation of war at any time. That seems preposterous to us, but it didn't to Soviet leaders, and particularly that wing of the Soviet leadership at the time that was most alarmed and concerned and about the United States' actions and most inclined to interpret our actions as not only unwarranted, but as deriving from a hostile intention.
KGB Center pushes Operation Ryan, February 1983. Excerpt from KGB cable translated by Oleg Gordievsky. Top secret, copy number one, London, Comrade Yermakov. Strictly personal. Permanent operational assignment to uncover NATO preparations for a nuclear missile attack on the USSR. In view of the growing urgency of the task of discovering promptly any preparations by the adversary for a nuclear missile attack, Ryan, on the USSR, we are sending you a permanently operative assignment and briefing on this question. The objective of the assignment is to see that the Residentura works systematically to uncover any plans in preparation by the main adversary, the United States, for Ryan, and to organize a continual watch to be kept for indications of a decision being taken to use nuclear weapons against the USSR or immediate preparations being made for a nuclear missile attack.
The first point I would like to make is that Australia was on the list of the countries which were supposed to be watched by the KGB and where from the KGB was supposed to send each fortnight a report about the preparation to a sudden nuclear attack on the Soviet Union. So in the 82, 83, 84, the KGB in Canberra was, and in Sydney, was watching the so-called preparation to a nuclear war.
Oleg Gordievsky, former KGB chief in London, in an interview recorded especially for this series by ABC TV's Andrew Fowler. By 1983, all of the Soviets' anxieties were focused on Germany. For 4 years, the Soviets and the United States had been playing a game of nuclear poker. At stake were hundreds of new missiles which NATO was planning to deploy in West Germany in the autumn of 1983. This new generation of nuclear-armed medium-range missiles would be able to reach targets in the Soviet Union in 8 minutes. Now, naturally enough, the Soviets were distinctly nervous about the arrival of these missiles in West Germany. But NATO claimed it was simply playing catch-up, matching a new fleet of Soviet missiles aimed at Europe, the SS-20s. Here's James Buchan, who followed the controversy over the Euro missiles as correspondent for the Financial Times in Bonn.
In the course of the 1970s, the Soviets started deploying a medium-range missile which NATO called the SS-20, which was capable of hitting targets all over Europe, all over Western Europe, but not of reaching the United States. And the purpose of this weapon, as became very clear at the end of the 70s and the beginning of the 80s, was to detach Western Europe from the US and eventually to clear the Americans out of the European continent.
How would it do that?
By so encouraging dissension and splitting public opinion in West Germany, which was the most sensitive and the most vulnerable country in the Western Alliance, which would then reject any counter-deployments by the United States and drift into neutrality.
In 1983, I knew these would be the capital events of my life. I couldn't know that the missiles deployed in West Germany that November would be the final shots of the last action of the Cold War. The Germans, who had rebuilt cities turned to rubble by British and American bombers in the Second World War, knew that they had most to lose from any deterioration in the balance of terror between the two great powers. Both Germanys were military camps, overflowing with armed men of all nationalities, bristling with nuclear weapons, churned up by tank manoeuvres, deafened by low-flying fighter aircraft.
From James Buchan's novel Heart's Journey in Winter, a spy thriller set in Germany during the war scare of 1983.
The rivalry between the two great powers was transferred from the real continent of cities and fields onto battlefields of the imagination. Ideology, though this had become degenerate by 1983, subversion, and the accumulation of nuclear weapons whose power to terrify and persuade depended not on their detonation, for that was too terrible even for the game at issue, but on their value as entries, as my father wrote in the 1960s, in some imaginary ledger of terror and might. The chief theatre of this mental war was Germany.
It was a real desire for peace and extreme fear of war.
Germany is the only country which gets Pershing IIs, and you must ask the question why, of all places, only Germany. Why isn't it not shared with all the other countries?
I think the Germans, most of the Germans, realized for the first time that nuclear war might come to their territory.
There's a certain creative fear in people, not fear that you manipulate, but a fear that Germany, which is already filled to the brim, east and west, by nuclear weapons, by chemical weapons, by conventional weapons, has an overkill on both sides of 40 times, begins to essay, why anymore? What is this? For what reason?
Petra Kelly, one of the leading figures in the West German peace movement, in a rare archival interview with Harry Kreisler of the University of California, Berkeley. It's part of their series, Conversations with History.
And Germany is, of course, in a position where many people don't want any other war to start again from German soil. So there was a strong appeal by old people, elderly people supporting us, and a strong appeal by many occupational groups, doctors, lawyers, scientists, professors, academic people, which also make up a big part of the Green Party. And people begin questioning why, in fact, do they have no say-so over these decisions.
What Petra Kelly called creative fear took hundreds of thousands of Germans onto the streets in the early 1980s. In 1979, the key NATO allies had moved to counter the Soviet SS-20s with missiles of their own. NATO declared that it would deploy American cruise and Pershing missiles in Germany by the end of 1983, unless the Soviets removed their SS-20s. But what the NATO leaders hadn't bargained for was a revolt from their own populations.
What the deployment of Cruise and Pershing gave them was a mass movement, millions strong. And, you know, mass movements always claim to be millions strong, but in the big popular demonstrations in the autumn of 83, there were millions of people going out onto the streets to demonstrate against the Pershings.
The whole bloody, grotesque, barbarous carnival is still there on the road. Already, it's getting darker in Europe. The nights are drawing in. Time is not on our side.
That was English historian E.P. Thompson, founder of the European Movement for Nuclear Disarmament, speaking in London to an estimated 1,250,000 campaigners for nuclear disarmament.
The Soviets had set out to sow dissension in Europe. By early 1983, they'd certainly succeeded. The campaign against Kruse and Pershing had spread to Britain. Meanwhile, in West Germany, the Social Democrat government had collapsed, deeply divided over the whole issue. Public opinion in Germany was split 50-50 on whether or not the deployments should go ahead. But there was one question which Germany's allies in Washington found perplexing. The Germans seemed a whole lot more frightened of the NATO missiles which were supposed to protect them than the Soviet missiles aimed at them.
The argument we kept making was that, we don't like them either, but unless we show the Soviets that we can counter the SS-20s, we won't get rid of them, and they're in a position to hold Europe hostage. Because the SS-20, which each of them had three warheads, highly accurate, and they could hit every NATO capital on the continent of Europe within about 4 minutes.
The United States must restore that nuclear balance, and if we fail to do so, the Soviet Union could, within a few years, be in a position to threaten us, blackmail our allies, or even launch a nuclear attack with the assurance that we would not be capable of responding in a way that would constitute effective deterrence.
This argument that we can be blackmailed if we give not a new answer to the SS-20 on the other side is completely wrong. Mm. We cannot be blackmailed. We have enough weapons now existing. We have the potentials of the French nuclear power, the Force Frappe of the United Kingdom, of the United States. We have three nuclear-armed countries in the Western Alliance. In the Warsaw Pact is only the Soviet Union nuclear power, and there's no possibility for the Soviets to blackmail a non-nuclear armed country in Western Europe, the Netherlands or the Germans or the Belgians or the Scandinavian countries. How could work such a blackmailing? I couldn't see.
General Gerd Bastian. Bastian was commander of the 12th Panzer Division of the German Bundeswehr, but he resigned his commission in protest over the plans to deploy Kruse and Pershing. Together with Petra Kelly, Bastian became an important spokesperson for the West German peace movement.
It is impossible to think that the Soviets can say, if Germany is not willing to leave the NATO, we will destroy Frankfurt or Hamburg with the SS-20 missile. Mm. I think it's crazy to came to such a...
I think, in fact, we're being blackmailed by thinking. The United States in an opposite... I think nuclear blackmail does exist because, in another sense. When the United States says we're going to forfeit Hamburg and perhaps Frankfurt because we don't want to forfeit New York, we scream and say we don't want to be the sacrifices because you don't use your intercontinental potential. So the whole idea of deterrence is an idea of keeping people hostages on both sides. In fact, we are hostages. And people begin questioning why, in fact, do they have no say-so over these decisions.
2 women stood with their backs to the kitchen sink. One was Caroline Bouchard, the wife of the British head of chancery. The other woman had a strikingly slim waist. She had her eyes down and her hand out.
Hi, I'm Paulina.
How do you do? Richard Fisher. I shook her cold hand.
You're with MI6, right?
You must be joking. Paulina pinched my right sleeve, took the bottle of wine, put it to her mouth and drank from it. She handed the bottle back to me and said,
"So what are you doing here?"
I said that for 35 years, Britain, France and the United States had been fighting the Soviets and one another for control of West German public opinion. Suddenly, it was as if a shell had burst overhead and exposed this dreary struggle to a blinding light. I went on a bit about Pershings and SS-20s, missile throw weights and explosive yield. I said we were now in the midst of a pitched engagement, the first since Cuba in 1962. The Soviets would again be beaten. But I just wished...
I meant here, Lennestrasse 43.
I think most of the Germans realized for the first time that nuclear war might come to their territory. As long as there was this American nuclear umbrella far in the distance with the threat of massive retaliation in case of an outbreak of war in Europe, the Germans felt more secure. because the United States was willing to risk its own fate in order to save West Germany from being overrun by the Soviets, or to be more precise, to serve the city of Berlin from falling into Soviet hands. And of course, this strategy was not all that popular in the United States. And of course, the United States, there were a lot of voices saying, why should we risk our territory and our country for the sake of West Germany or Berlin if we have the chance to limit it to the European theater of war in case there would be an escalation?
Bernd Schaefer, senior fellow at the German Historical Institute in Washington. As one British politician once put it, the NATO alliance was all about keeping the Americans in, the Germans down, and the Russians out.